For the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Well, that was incredible. A real test of whether you can sing or not is whether you can sing without accompaniment. And I have perfect pitch, but not sure that, didn't know that the rest of you did. But no, it was, you were on key, on tune. And can we say that, Mrs. Tanner? They were on key, weren't they? She's the musician here, so. I don't know if any of you remember this individual, but there was a senator from the state of Illinois. He was quite a colorful character. He died in 1969. Everett Dirksen, did any of you ever remember him? He was kind of a colorful individual, and he's credited with the quotation, "A billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money." The colorful senator from Illinois made it a point about government collecting and spending that in the 1960s was colossal and unimaginable in its scope. But seriously, can you remember when a billion was a big number? Because it just doesn't seem to be a big number by comparison anymore. If you watch or listen to the news, you've probably been assaulted with the trillions of dollar figure, so much so recently that a mere billion seems inconsequential. It's insignificant by comparison. And a million, that's hardly worth mentioning. A million dollars is hardly anything anymore. The famed astronomer Carl Sagan would be irrelevant in today's age with his billions and billions comments that he used to make, and that used to be a joke that was made by comedians about how he said that. Evidently, since he died in 1996, it's not so much funny anymore. So, judging by your response. The crisis occurring center stage in our nation presently is a debt and deficit crisis in which the politicians are attempting to solve, and very likely there will be some kind of last-minute quote solution will probably arrive, product of compromise between two parties. My guess is it won't solve the problem long term, but that's just my guess. And, you know, what I've seen happen with compromise positions and how that happens. But the greater issue for many of us is assessing whether or not an event such as this holds much significance in a prophetic sense. And I'll bet you've wondered about that. And I mean, it is a crisis. Correct? It is a crisis of unimaginable consequence. At least that's what we're told, and we're on the precipice of danger. We're at the very edge of the cliff. It could be one of the worst calamities of our lifetimes. We could have a default, could have a downgrade in credit rating, the stock market could crash, and all of this could happen. To put the problem in perspective, our national debt is about equal to what we as a country annually produce, or the gross national product, about $14 trillion. This is how much money we owe to other nations, to ourselves, and we pay interest on this amount to service that debt. And so far, the only governmental solutions that would seem to have enough support are in reality only short-term solutions to a huge problem. In September of 1999, I gave a sermon entitled The American Century, and that sermon was a reflection of history and prophecy, and I discussed how dominant the United States has been throughout the 20th century. And even though, technically speaking, 1999 or the end of 1999 wasn't really the end of the decade, 2000 would be. A lot of people got that confused. So to be topical, I just entitled it The American Century, even though we weren't really at the end just yet. But at that time, there seemed to be no lack of dominance within sight for the United States. I know that understanding conditions and events in the world can be a tricky business and one that eludes even the experts. I mean, many times the predictions, if you examine them, if you go back and examine a lot of the predictions, whether it has to do with what's going to happen in the year ahead or 10 years ahead, most of them are so far off base that it's It's funny in a retrospective way. I mean, in 1955, I think it was Life magazine or Time magazine. I think it was Life magazine at the time, which was one of the greatest of the magazines. You know, basically a pictorial essay of what was going on in the world at that time, predicted, or maybe it was Look magazine. Yeah, as a matter of fact, and I think about it, it was Look magazine, predicted that by the year 1985, or was it 75, that the preferred mode of transportation for most people would be helicopters. We'd all be flying around in helicopters. We'd have heliports in our backyards. We'd be flying around. I mean, that was the thinking at that time in the early 50s that we'd all be. Anybody get here by helicopter today? Well, didn't think so. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 4, last chapter of Daniel, a lot is packed in, prophetically speaking, to the book of Daniel. But in this verse, it says, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." Now, that is a prophecy that I think we can say is constantly being fulfilled and certainly shows us that we're in the time era when a lot of things can happen in a lifetime. And you're living in that lifetime, and knowledge increases by vast sums. And it's really amazing the technology that has made information so readily available to all of us. It's just unbelievable, and that virtually everybody who has a home computer has more computing power at their fingertips than the computers that enabled an astronaut to land on the moon in 1969, just on top of your desk, whereas it used to occupy buildings, you know, many, many buildings. I remember the first time I saw the mainframe computer, the IBM 360, I think it was, out in Pasadena. It was state-of-the-art. It was incredible. We used it to run everything, and it is so vastly inferior to just any computer that is occupying somebody's home today that it's unbelievable. But it occupied rooms, and it had false floors and everything. Well, all the wires and cooling systems and everything were part of it, and that was in the early 80s, and it was state-of-the-art. And now virtually any laptop computer is far superior to all of that. And we have all of that available to us. And, you know, it's just amazing how easy it is to access information and to understand things. And the capacity is so much greater. So it seems undeniable that even just by the force of this small prophecy that we live in the time of the end. But the one thing that we don't know is how long will the time of the end be? How long will it last? We do have a general outline of the future from the prophetic writings of the Bible. We're conditioned to watch world events almost from the same perspective as the pundits and the commentators of the present day and the or the past day. Or the, oh, yeah, that's nice. I was just wondering why it was so dark in here when I walked in. Wow, we're either losing power or, you know, maybe somebody's eyes hurt or something. But thank you for that. That makes it a little easier to actually read my notes. Let's see. I think I skipped a bunch. No, okay. But, you know, let's face it. In some ways, is it not true? Maybe it's not true for you, so I don't want to generalize or paint everybody with a broad brush. But is it not true that we are almost conditioned to look for prophetic events almost from the same kind of crisis mentality that moves the world? I mean, everything up, you know, everything becomes a crisis to which we must act upon. I mean, I'm speaking from a national perspective. There's a crisis here, a crisis there. It seems as though that's the way it is because, and it's not anything that's brand new either. I go back to the 60s when the environmental movement began, and I was a young person. I was in high school, and we had some very politically active science professors who taught us over the dangers of the ecology and how it was being wrecked and ruined and how horrifying it could all be and everything. And as a matter of fact, you know, you can go into some cities today that many years ago were dirty and crummy and horrible and rotten looking like Pittsburgh, and now they're beautiful cities. They're, you know, they've been cleaned up. I mean, so the implications or the far-reaching implications of crisis sometimes is used to sell an agenda, but it shouldn't be something that should sell prophecy to us. And quite honestly, if we look back, those of us that have been veteran for many, many years, we'll have to admit that the crisis mentality did kind of fuel the selling or the idea that Bible prophecy was valid. But I don't think that we really need that at this stage of the game. Like many of you, I've been a student of Bible prophecy for many years. And like many of you, I suspect my watching of world events has often been fueled by the day-to-day conditions that we observe and what we see happening in the news. I think sometimes it's good for us to just kind of pull back and take a look at what really is happening. And, you know, some of this, obviously, you're going to have to separate my opinion from what is really factual, because in any sermon, as I've said before, there's going to be some opinion that is stated. That's, you know, the job of the listener to sort that out, agree or disagree. You may be right. I may be right. We may both at some point be right, even if we have slightly different views. But I've often found, and I've mentioned these before, and I'll mention them again, because I think that as a broad and general guideline outlook for prophecy, they're still valid. Mr. Armstrong wrote about them one time in an article and then republished it several times. But, you know, watch for what is happening in the United States and the British Commonwealth. Mr. Carrillo kind of touched a little bit on that in the sermonette today. Watch for the rise of the United States of Europe. And that's something that has been happening for 60 years. You know, it's not, you can't say something is a crisis if it takes 60, 70, 80 years for it to come to fruition. It's not, it could arise suddenly. I mean, it could coalesce and things could happen very quickly at the end. But this is something we've been watching for a long time. Watch for an increasingly powerful European church and influence. And watch what happens in the Middle East and watch what happens in the Church of God. Those were the five areas. And I think that they do present a great outline for evaluating world events and the conclusion of Bible prophecy. And what I've also come to see is that the experts and their I'm not talking about biblical experts, I'm talking about national experts and people who talk about what's going to happen in the future, they are so often wrong and sometimes so spectacularly wrong that it's the funny thing is that very oftentimes they're not really held up to scrutiny when their ideas and, you know, their prognostications fail. Sometimes they're driven by personal agendas or political agendas that blur the reality. And I go all the way back to my days when I began to become politically aware as an individual, as a teenager, and, you know, realize some of the things that I was misguided on at that particular time. Now, today, for instance, let's just isolate today. We are in the current time in a current economic crisis, and I'm not minimizing that there is a severe problem. There is a real severe problem. Much of it has been brought about, kind of, in my view, needlessly so. And I draw back upon my training, and when I went to college before going to Ambassador College, we had an economics class, had a rather good economics professor who presented us with two books, one written by John Maynard Keynes, and we had to read that, and another one written by Friedrich von Hayek. Both of these were very influential, genius people who basically represented two opposing views of economic theory. And those theoretical assertions by these two individuals have had a lot to do with the economic system of the modern world in the 20th century and the United States. And much of our system has been built on the idea of John Maynard Keynes, who thought that you could prime the pump or stimulate the economy with government spending and so on and so forth. And generally, the government prints more money, dumps it into the banking system, and that is something that apparently is thought to create a stimulus for a short time. That is basically the economic theory that is holding true, or the ideas that are being promulgated and have for the past few years in this same period of time. The theories of John Maynard Keynes were violently opposed by this other economic theoretician by the name of Friedrich von Hayek. And we read his book, his famous book written in the 1940s, which was entitled The Road to Serfdom. And in Hayek's view, he outlined that if the state continued to control the economic conditions rather than the free market, it would eventually lead a society to ruin, and thus the serfdom notation at the end that would rob the individual initiative. And since 2008, in our present administration, at any rate, the Keynesian theorists have been firmly in control, and so as a national economy, we've borrowed more and more money, created stimulus, printed money, and we've accumulated, and this is the aspect that, you know, I think the American public is kind of waking up to a little bit more than they were. We have accumulated more debt as a nation in the last 3 years than we had since the entire time of our republic from George Washington up until that time. So it's kind of why a lot of people are concerned. And to put it in real terms, my two little granddaughters, one 5 and one 2 years old, from the time of their birth, their share of that debt was already over $40,000 and counting. Get a job, will you? I mean, it's time to start paying up. So it is a serious, serious situation. I'm not trying to diminish the extent of the problem that America faces from an economic standpoint, but I also want to balance that with the understanding that today, I don't think this is going to happen, but today, a solution could be reached that would be absolutely painless for the country, would erase that debt in a very short period of time. I'm speaking of maybe 4 or 5 years or so. And it would trigger an economic boom in our nation. And those solutions for erasing debt and creating a booming economy are within reach. And they're supported by the vast majority of Americans, when they realize them, no matter what their political leanings or affiliation, they realize that it would happen. In Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, there's a verse here that I think is often misconstrued, and it's speaking about the rule of Jesus Christ on this earth, and the prophecy begins from the time of 4 BC when Christ was born, but of course predicted hundreds of years prior to that time. Isaiah 9 and verse 6 says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Some have mistakenly thought that this is an endorsement of big government, or even, you know, God's government getting bigger, 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 you know, big, huge government. You know, I mean, well, it's not really an endorsement for big government. If it were an endorsement for big government, if that were the case, then we'd have many blessings because our U.S. government is big. It's huge. It consumes a lot of money every day. But the one thing that, as I've been viewing this crisis that is coming upon us, or the deadline of August 2nd, everybody's, if you're within earshot of a radio or a TV, you've heard of this deadline. You know, that's the drop-dead deadline for saving the country, saving, you know, everything that we have economically. What is so often lost in the debate that is going on is how wasteful much of this present human government is. I mean, I remember during my lifetime there was something created by fiat. You know, this is the one beautiful thing that politicians can do. They can create things out of thin air, like the Department of Energy. And all of a sudden a department was created. Have any of you ever, you're American citizens, and I'm not trying to lampoon our government or anything like that. Well, maybe I am in a way. But have any of you ever received any direct or indirect benefit from something called the Department of Energy? It is a vast, vast government program and department. But You cannot find out what they have done. Ostensibly, the Department of Energy was designed, you know, when it sprang into existence? During the energy crisis of 1974, when some of us were standing in the line waiting to pump gas because gas had to be allocated. You remember those? Well, I was out of the country in those days, but for some of you, remember the time in which, I can't remember if it was odd number license plates you could buy on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then other times, you know, other people could buy gas on other days because we had a shortage. It was an artificial shortage. There really wasn't any shortage at all, but the Department of Energy was ostensibly created to help us to become energy independent. And, it hasn't happened. I mean, it's been in existence since 1974. And if anybody can challenge me and bring me one good thing that that department has done for us or problems that it solved, then I will publicly retract some of what I'm saying. Or the Department of Education or many other departments that seemingly have endless budgets and workers accomplishing virtually nothing, yes. But even at that, even with all of the waste and, you know, your tax dollars being wasted hither and yon, even at that, our nation is still so great that it can absorb all sorts of misguided and stupid policies and wastefulness that is just so incredible, and ineptness that it still is the greatest nation on the face of the earth. It really is. I mean, if you're going to be objective and take a look at things the way they really are, that is the conclusion that you come to. I mean, you can't come to any other. You can say that we're going downhill. We're on a however steep, you know, your slide is. Maybe it's a cliff. You know, maybe we are at the precipice. Maybe we're at the edge. But in Matthew chapter 24 and in verse 23, Christ had sat down with his disciples at the temple. And he said, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. I can tell you that we are not at that time. I mean, there aren't anyone at this stage of the game, at least that I know of, that is saying, there's Christ. And although there may be false Christs and false prophets on the horizon, there's none that are showing great signs and wonders, deceiving, if possible, even the elect. Now, in verse 32, it says, now learn this parable of the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. And assuredly, I say to you, this generation or this age, it should read age. Genea is the Greek word. It should be age. You shouldn't think of it as a physical generation or a span of time like, you know, a generation which normally would last 25 or 30 years. It's talking about an age. And so this age will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So only the Father knows the time of Christ's return. So it's all attempts to try to quantify that or look for that or to talk about that even is silly, because the point is that if you're going to be watching what's happening in the world, then you'll be at the right place in the right time. You'll be doing the right things so that that won't take you by surprise. But all of this is preceded by, as we go back to the beginning of the chapter in verse 3, it says, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Aha, finally, there was a point in time when the disciples did begin to get it. They thought at first, originally, that Christ was there to set up his kingdom in the present day. and they may have thought that it would only be a short time until he left and came back, but they did realize, and they began to realize because he had told them this a number of times, that he would have to go and he would come back. And so they wanted to know, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying I am the Christ, and will deceive many. That has happened for 2,000 years, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. And that has happened and will continue to happen. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Now, we have had all of those events. And yet, nobody in the right mind is going to say, we are really, really close right now, within days of Christ's return. In their time, they thought Christ would return. But that information at least began to be understood, and so he's trying to give them some context. All of these items are just even, as he says, the beginning of sorrows. Famine, pestilence, nation rising against nation, wars, rumors of wars, earthquakes, these are just the beginning of sorrows. Do they explain our current day? While we've experienced virtually all of these in one way or another, at least vicariously, by watching them on the news or listening about them on the radio, they haven't had to happen to the point to where they are concurrently, nor are they at the beginning of sorrows. So we really can't objectively say we're at that point. We're at the beginning of sorrows. I mean, yes, are people's lives impacted every day? Do the people of Japan think that as they went through this tsunami and earthquake and resultant tsunami, did that have an incredible impact in that part of the world? Obviously it did. But Christ goes on to say in verse 9, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. So that kind of puts us a little closer to where the reality of the situation is. We know that that's in the future because we are not in a time of tribulation, the point of people killing others and severe hatred, which would cause that kind of killing. And then it says there, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. He who endures to the end shall be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Now, the good news of God's kingdom has not yet reached the world. Now, it has at times, and it has reached certain segments of people, or else none of us would have been called by that good news. But it has not yet been spread in mass to the world. But let me caution you. I certainly don't want you to leave the service today saying, oh, well, Mr. Buchanan, or you could say it more sarcastically, Buchanan doesn't really believe that prophecy is really happening or unfolding or blah, 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 blah. No, far be it from that. I think that we are in an even more important time than that. Because our nation is still so great, and because our nation is, I mean, the very fact that people are so conscientious, that many, many people have been awakened to the fact that this crisis economically could have such a profound impact upon their lives, and no matter what they might believe politically, they don't like it. They don't like the fact that the loss of the credit rating of the United States could result in severely higher interest costs on their credit cards. It could affect the price of gas could skyrocket. I mean, people are very concerned, and they understand that those are the potential consequences of what is happening right now. And so they want change. People are crying out for change. People always cry out for governmental change. But when you take a look at the most prophetic of all books that we could imagine, the book of Revelation, it is filled with drama, incredible events, dramatic undertakings, plagues, war, deception on a grand scale, angels, angels of every type and description, apparently. Turn to Revelation chapter 14. Now, I hope to bring this to a close at some point, the point at which I think that it's more important now as a Christian than perhaps it has ever been to be a Christian, because of the relative greatness that we still see. And as I said in 1999, that the 20th century was an American century. This nation dominated the world and dominated world events like no other nation has ever in history, far surpassing the influence of every great empire that ever existed. Egypt, Greece, Rome, Babylon, all of them put together were never as great as this country. Never, ever. And it's not being jingoistic, which means super patriot for those that don't know that word. I think that's what it means. Better check with somebody afterwards. But in our technological society today, somebody could get on their Droid or their Apple phone and they could look that up and they could give me a no or a yes right now. And that's how, you know, it's fulfilled the prophecy of Daniel 12:4. Revelation chapter 14 is an inset chapter into the story flow of the book of Revelation. And in verse 1, it says, that means there is a, what I mean by that is there is a story flow, chronological flow roughly of the book of Revelation. Mr. Tanner talked about the last two sermons that he gave, pardon me, the tests for Valley Fever, by the way, were ruled negative. And I guess that explains my dry hacking cough. Maybe not. But the book of Revelation basically flows in a chronological view, and then there are chapters that are inset into the story flow. And this is one of those chapters. And in vision, John is taken to, and he says, I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion. Mount Zion is a synonym for the church of God. That is why when we sing the song, Mount Zion stands so beautiful, a joy in all the land, I think it's such a beautiful song because it's not speaking of a location or a place. It's speaking about perfected saints. And that is what John sees. I saw the Lamb, so Christ, standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters, and the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. This is beautiful. This is majestic. This is on such a grand scale. And it says, they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who are not defiled with women. Women being a synonym for church in the book of Revelation, a false church, false women, harlots, as it were, in the previous chapter and then in chapter 17. For they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These are redeemed from among men, being firstfruits to God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. This is in vision. It's majestic. It's lofty. It's an incredible description of the church of God. All without sin. All perfect. Justified standing before God. And that's what John saw. That is a prophecy of your life, you might say. Now in verse 6, it says, I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Now remember, Christ said that one of the signs of the end of the age would be that the gospel would be preached in all nations. Part of that apparently will be done by the church, the finishing job done by this powerful angel, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. So this simply says that the gospel will be preached in all the world. And since this is an inset chapter in the story flow, there will apparently be as well, if you'll go, well, you don't have to turn there, but if you'll read in chapter 7 of Revelation, you find that the 144,000 are also mentioned there, but also an innumerable multitude who apparently come from the preaching of the gospel done by this mighty angel from all tribes, all tongues, all peoples, accomplishing something and preaching the gospel that it would be perhaps impossible for just men to do. Verse 8 says, and another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen. You know, it fell once. It's going to fall again. This system upon which this world has been built, this system of, you know, as Mr. Armstrong used to compare the two trees in the Garden of Eden, you know, one of self-realization, self-actualization, and self-determination that mankind chose through Adam and Eve, and the other one of the tree of life. But this one is going to be cut down, this particular tree, for once and all, because the whole world has been built on that false system. That great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And so there will be, and the previous chapter talks about it, there will be this unification of church and state. Now, right now, I got to tell you, I don't see that on the scene. I don't see that appearing on the scene. That is, the crisis in Europe is not to that point. I mean, we can all look up different things throughout history that have happened, significant events here and there and such, so on and so forth. But I remember listening to one of the instructors on the refresher program years ago when we were living on the Gunlap mentality, prophetically speaking, and remembering the lecturer talking about the very nature of Pope John Paul. And that pope is the one that did a great deal of peacemaking, you know, being from Poland. He was kind of an outsider, but he did so many wonderful things. But his attitude was of such humility that there is no way that he could have occupied the office that is described of in Revelation 13. And so I really don't know much about the current pontiff, the current pope, and maybe you don't either. But we don't see, again, even in this one, that kind of mentality, at least yet. So those signs ought to be somewhat evident. So this angel shows the very quick destruction of this system in which the beast power has been built, and that's described in the previous chapter. We won't go there today. Verse 10, he himself also shall drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with a fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast in his image and who receives his mark, the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and faith of Jesus. So in this we find a brief description of what will happen during the great tribulation. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. So it's kind of encapsulating other things that are mentioned throughout the book of Revelation regarding a time of great tribulation that will fall upon the earth. Now in verse 14 it says, then I looked, and behold, a white cloud. And on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel. Well, there's just angels everywhere, powerful beings coming out to do the work of God. And another angel coming out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, Thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So he who sat on the cloud thrust his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. And then another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, and he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, who had power over the fire, and he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. It's beautiful language, very poetic, very destructive things happening at the hands of God's righteous angels. And the winepress was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. So three more angels describing the actions around the time of Christ's return. Now, let's back up. To place our current events into context, these are mind-boggling, not only life-changing, but world-changing events, incredible things that are going to happen. And when I analyze what is happening in the world today, it's my assessment, a personal opinion, okay, that in our country, we are a center-right country. Now, are we a perfect country? No. But most people are more conservative than they are liberal. And not saying one is good, one is bad. These are political manifestations that people place on things. But basically, we are a country that is a country of law, that believes in its founding, believes that the founding fathers had a pretty good idea and were based on the biblical record that they had available to them. Again, my opinion. Also my opinion that the base is aware of horrendous problems that we face economically. And it's, if I were to make a prediction, I would say that the country and the government would swing. It's not reflected in the government so much now being more conservative, but I would guess that there would be a swing back to that. And that's going to take 15 months to accomplish, but that's just a personal opinion. So when I view prophecy, I try to take a very long-term view, 5, 10 years ahead, 20 years ahead, because we really don't know how long it is until the return of Jesus Christ. My training has been, whether it was intentional or not, in the church, my training has been to look at the immediate events of the day and translate them into the prophetic record, and sometimes that just doesn't fit. But I could very well be horribly wrong, so you cannot base your life on my opinion, obviously. I could be so horribly wrong that, you know, you don't want to base your life, your faith, on somebody's opinion or conjecture, which is all mine is, or prediction, which is all mine is. But what should you do until these momentous times? And I've just picked out one chapter, chapter 14 of Revelation. Angel upon angel having great influence and exerting incredible power upon the world compared with today, you know, people standing in front of a microphone pontificating about what they think is the right solution to a problem that we face as a nation. There's no comparison. And we haven't even led up to those times yet that are described in this chapter. But what I can't, so I'm not going to tell you where we are in prophecy because I have no clue. And I don't think you do either. But I can tell you what your responsibility is as a minister and as an individual. I can tell you what the Bible tells us to do, and part of that is found in 2 Corinthians, a highly prophetic book, 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3. No matter what happens in life, a requirement of a Christian is to do this. Now, it just so happens that the people that Paul wrote to in Thessalonica, they thought the end was soon. They thought it was incredibly close because of the conditions of the day. And they looked around at what is happening and, you know, society is going downhill so fast, they must have thought, what do we do? Some people decided the best thing to do would be to wait and not really do anything productive in their lives. Wait this one out. Wait till Christ returns. Wait. Hold on. Wait. Don't do anything. Don't really accomplish. You can read the books of Thessalonians. You'll see that that was a prevalent attitude that Paul was dealing with. That's why he says, you know, my example was I worked with my own hands when I was among you. He was a tent maker. He says, this is what I did. But some people began to mooch off of others. And that is documented in this book. But he tells them, but as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. So many of the same conditions they felt existed in prophecy, but they really didn't have the full picture. They thought they lived in the time of the end. And that's what makes the study of Paul's writings so instructive for us today, because these same warnings apply. The best thing, I'm going to recant everything. If today you walk out of the building and there's going to be fires and earthquakes and tribulation and armies surrounding Jerusalem all of a sudden, you know, creating it desolate, and, you know, all bets are off then, okay? If that happens right after you walk out of here. Since that's not likely to happen, what do we do in the meantime? You want to stay vigilant. You want to be ready. You want to be a good Christian. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. In this chapter, there are many, many wonderful affirmations of the Christian life. And they were concerned about what was happening in their day and age 2,000 years ago. He said, but concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. It's going to catch this world unaware. That is what he is saying. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day, but we are not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. Now, this aspect of watching may have a certain relevancy to watching what is happening in the world, but it has more relevancy when Christ said to watch in Luke 21 and Matthew 24. He wasn't talking about watching ABC News or Fox or CNN or whatever. I mean, are you going to rely on that as your barometer for what really is happening? Because much of the time, any news is driven by sometimes motives that you may be unaware as a listener or as a watcher. That's not what is necessarily meant by watching. We are to look at ourselves, let us watch and be sober. It has to do with your personal relationship with God, and he emphasizes that because he says, for those who sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. It's not in this sense a condemnation on sleep or being drunk, although being drunk is not good, and the Bible explains that elsewhere. It has to do with a spiritual condition, just as it mentions that sobriety is a matter of a spiritual condition. You know, good if you're sober. I mean, if you're physically sober, that's fine, but that's not the intention. The intention here is to be sober from a spiritual standpoint, because he says, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. That is the responsibility of a Christian in any age. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. He had just finished explaining the resurrection in the previous chapter. So whether we're dead or whether we're alive, or whether we're alive or dead, we should live together with him. Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another just as you're doing. And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. and be at peace among yourselves. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. See that no one renders evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good both for yourselves and for all. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. Do not quench the Spirit, do not despise prophecies, test all things, hold fast what is good, abstain from every form of evil. That is the greatest protection and the greatest, these are the greatest things that a Christian can do no matter what the age. And I think that, as I said, I think that sometimes, you know, events that happen on a national scene, I mean, yes, let's back up and let me give some context. Have we been in some really troubling times lately in our nation? Yes. Problems in an economy that shouldn't be, and needless problems, I might add. I think most people who are honest would assess these things are so easily averted. You know, our unemployment is around 9% in our nation. It's probably really at just around 20% of people that could be employed. That is horrible. And it's also something that could easily be solved. I'm not running for office, so I'm not going to tell you what would solve it. And you're not going to vote for me anyway, so I'm not even going to get into that. But the point is, we are not faced with that double-digit unemployment problem just as one problem because we have volcanoes and hurricanes and earthquakes that have just devastated the nation and plummeted us into further and further crisis. They're not problems that are a result of anything other than policies, which could be changed, which could turn things around very, very quickly. I hope that's, you know, you may disagree with me, and if you do, then that's fine. We don't have to argue about it or be upset with each other about it. That's my opinion. I'm just trying to stress that the country is so wealthy that it's able to absorb multitudes of problems. I mean, so wealthy, so solid in many, many ways. Now, could that erode very quickly? Yes, obviously it can. It can. But there are so many issues and difficulties that could be basically solved with a stroke of a pen here and if people were willing to do it. And, you know, that's what we see. So Paul gives us some great guidelines for how we should act in whatever age that we find ourselves. Now also, I'm going to close with this final scripture, John 3 and verse 16. I find that it is so easy to blame so many things on, quote, the world. You know, there are two ways to look at the world, and there is the Bible explains this present evil world, which means that there is a system of thinking that is contrary to God that developed from the time of Adam and Eve's choice. But there is also the people of the world. And John 3:16, probably a memory verse for anybody that ever went to any kind of church. God so loved the world. He didn't love the evil system that sprang up when he gave Adam and Eve a choice. He didn't love, and he doesn't love, the deceit and the hatred and the animosity and the anti-God approach found so often, or the lack of any kind of love. But he does love the individual, and he gave his son to die for everyone in the world. When you're viewing prophecy and when you're viewing what happens in the world, as a Christian, it is incumbent upon you to love the individual and to love the world as God does. And let's face it, there are times when all of us, well, many of us who have been around for some time, there are times in our culture when we haven't love the world. We have actually, even sometimes from the pulpit, hated the world. And I don't mean the system, we have castigated and blamed the individual that God says he sent his son to die for. So we have to be careful, even in our analysis of prophecy, of, you know, whatever dramatic event may happen, like happened in September 11th of 2001, we have to be careful to not assess, oh, this is God's judgment. This is not God's judgment on the nation. This is something that happened. We should love the world. Our problems in our nation, even right now, do have solutions, and sometimes in a very ordinary sense that the public common person could actually, if he were king for a day, solve. But he'd have to be a king because he wouldn't be able to do it because there's so many opposing views to whatever, you know, the right one might be. But be that as it may, there are many things that can and will happen. I mean, from Revelation 24 to from Matthew 24 to Revelation 14, we are speaking of dynamic events. And we know they're going to happen. And we may someday soon be at the threshold, be at the door. But in the meantime, there are many things that we can do. And the Bible gives us the code that we live by. And that's what your greatest protection is ever going to be anyway.